From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We are 1 week away from our connection, which is the 50th anniversary of the start of what became known as the Rochester Race Riots. Though you're going to hear in this hour that many called it not a riot but a rebellion, and for many obvious reasons. But there's a film that tells the story better than anything that we could do, and we want to go back to that film this hour, one of the most important films ever made in this community. It's called July 64. 10 years ago, it was created to mark 40 years, and as we move toward 50 years, we're looking at the impact of those 3 days of violence and confrontation, the impact in Rochester, the impact around the country, but I think maybe just as importantly, we're looking at what led up to those events, and that's what this film does so well, and I think so importantly well, understanding the full context of it. The two filmmakers, the director and the producer, are here. Carvin Eisen is the director, Chris Christopher, the producer. Carvin, nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
And thank you for having us, Evan.
Chris, I say the producer, also the writer of the film, and it is a fabulous film, and I say that with all due respect to other documentarians. It's one of the most important documentaries I've ever seen. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Evan, and thank you for those kind words.
WXXI is proud to bring it back, and we'll be sharing the air dates with you coming up here. You're going to have a chance to see it not only on WXXI TV, but also on City 12 multiple times over the next week as we move toward that marking 50 years. And so let me start with just a basic question for our filmmakers. Let me start with this, Carvin. When you want to create a film like this, there are so many different ways to tell this story. There are so many different people you could go to, and you have tremendous power as a filmmaker. How did you and Chris end up getting together and doing this in the first place? How did that partnership come about?
Well, we don't have enough time to go into all of that in the time that we have, but I can just say that the most important thing about a documentary film that separates it from narrative and other filmmaking forms is the idea of telling the truth. And as soon as you start talking about the truth, that can be very subjective. But there is a truth. There are facts that actually took place. There are things that happened. And this was the making of July 64, Roots of Urban Unrest, was the first time that anyone ever tried to reconstruct what happened almost not hour to hour, but certainly event to event over the 3 day period. And more important than just the 3 days of violence is some of the things that happened that caused it in the first place, some of the backstory.
Absolutely.
The migration patterns, the living conditions, the police force, and all of those kinds of things.
Chris Christopher, so Carvin is talking about the importance of the way that this story is told. What's your relationship with Carvin? I'm curious to know how you ended up in this partnership.
Well, actually, this is part of that answer to that question is really how the film evolved. Carvin and I had been working together on a wonderful project to help people connect with housing opportunities. And while we were making that series, back in the old days when we were analog editing, meant that we were sitting together for long periods
yes,
of time
indeed.
With plenty of time to talk. And while we were actually working on that series, there was a PBS series running called Africans in America. And one of the things that Carvin and I started talking about was this series, because I would come in and say, having watched this series, say to Carvin, how is it that I don't know these stories? I have a good education. I'm a reader. I have a lot of curiosity about things. This is American history, and why don't I know it? And this led us to a lot of conversations about how history evolves, who gets to tell the story. And in many cases, history is formed by contemporaneous news accounts. And if those news accounts are flawed or missing a piece or missing a voice, the ongoing history is going to be flawed. So we started talking about what kind of a challenge that was for people like us who were interested in the kind of work that we do. About that same time, two very influential African-American figures in this community passed away. And David Gant came to us and said, you know, our history is dying. You've got these skills. figure something out. So Carvin and I sat down and thought about what was really one of the formative, transformative events in the history of this community, this particular episode from July 24th to July 26, 1964, and decided that that was a story that we really wanted to go back and talk about. So we started out thinking we were working on a short-term project, a 13-part series that actually led to a relationship and a body of work that spanned for nearly 10 years, including this piece.
Okay. And that was 1998, by the way, when that conversation first started taking place. So,
and here we are in 2014, and let me give you the schedule. If you haven't seen this film, WXXI-TV is going to show it this coming Monday at 9 p.m., then the following Sunday, the 27th, at 11 p.m., City 12, Time Warner Cable 12 in the city of Rochester. Two different showings on the anniversary, the 24th, that's a week from today, 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. I'll go over those again later in the hour if you missed it. But it's I couldn't agree more, Chris. This is must-see. For me, I remember the first time seeing it, I remember thinking, okay, I moved to Rochester 11 years ago. Why don't I know about this? Mm-hmm. This is American history. As the film indicates, again, this isn't an isolated, this isn't the only city. I mean, I remember that line in the city where someone makes a point that said, okay, as the black community increased, people felt like they couldn't get jobs. It was known that factories weren't hiring minorities. And if Rochester was the only place where it was happening, you could go to Buffalo, you could go to Syracuse. But it wasn't. It was all over the north and northeast, which is supposed to be where the opportunity was. So maybe let's start kind of the conversation in the film. Let's back it up here. You both decided the story had to start not that night on Friday night, July 24th, 1964. You had to start it at the time before that population change happened. And between 1950 and 1960, the black population grew by 300% here. And it sort of led us to look at the phrase smug town. And I was so moved by the way you told that. So let's start with what smug town meant. What did smug town really mean? Because sometimes in the modern day we hear smug town, we might not know the roots of it. It's a very important part of the 1950s and 60s in Rochester. Chris,
Smug Town was a book that was written by a man named Kurt Gerling. It took the city by storm. It was a gossipy book. It exposed a lot of people. And what his foundation premise was, and this is spoken to by several people in the film, was that this was a place where people felt that we really had things all locked up. We didn't need help from the federal government. We did not have we did have public housing by 1964, but we were the last city in New York State to get public housing. And as the reporter Jack German says, is because they felt they didn't need public housing.
Right, right.
They didn't want government interference. Everybody had a good job. Kodak was paying big bonuses. Everybody was living many people were living a life that was a good life for them, but they had blinders on to everything else that was going on around them. And this led to a feeling of smugness, a feeling that we do better, we are better than everyone else. And this was very much the majority opinion. So with this being the majority point of view, the city's image of itself, which was, you know, pretty darn lofty, pretty darn smug, they just did not want to see anything that shattered their own perception and illusion of who they were. Kurt Gerling's book challenged that and kind of set people talking.
But I think you should, this is important, I want to pick up on this point. The city had a right to be maybe not smug, but certainly had a right to be think very positively about itself. Rochester was, and Monroe County, was in fact at that time the wealthiest county in the country. Rochester was the, and Monroe County were the Silicon Valley of its period. And there was wealth. It was dramatic. There was no question about that.
What was unemployment? 2 or 3%?
2 or 3%, mm-hmm. according to Jack German. But while all of this is going on, particularly through the 50s and into the early 60s, the African American population, due to historic migration patterns, was increasing by 300%. So just imagine that if this room were to increase by the population by 300% in the next 10 minutes, that's going to have an impact on the quality of life within the city, within the community, and that's what was taking place.
Okay, and so a couple of points on the whole Smoketown thing, by the way. Chris is saying that at the time, Rochester was saying, we don't need help from anybody. The remnants of that 50 years later, that's a big reason why we've always gotten less state aid than Buffalo and Syracuse, by the way. Isn't that right, Chris?
Yes, it's absolutely correct.
Because we didn't ask for the help and we didn't get it.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely correct.
So that's one of the remnants. But the difference between what Carvin's saying and Smoketown is this to me. If you are confident and you are happy that the 2 to 3 percent unemployment is tremendous, the wealth, the relative prosperity, great. There's a difference between being proud and being smug. And here's where the smug comes in. And this is where the film, July 64, tells that. When the population of minorities in this community began to change, this community could have done two things. We could have said, we are doing so well, they had 10,000 jobs open. And you have all this influx of population. You could have opened your doors. This community could have said, let's embrace diversity. Let's continue to grow. We're doing so well. What better place for people to come? And that would have been a tremendous transition to be able to build this community. Or the community could have smugly said, we're going to ignore. We're going to essentially, the black population will be clustered in, what was it, the 3rd and 7th wards. And no jobs in factories for minorities, and let's just pretend that's not a problem, and we are going to have blinders to that, and this good life that we've created, and mostly white life, is going to continue no matter the reality. And I think that's the difference.
And you know, the interesting thing about that, Evan, at least to me, is this, that very mindset is what helped perpetrate the mythology of this event up until this film was made. If you look back at the newspaper accounts, if you talk to people who lived through those days, people would continue to say, right up to the point that we were making the film, we don't know why it happened. We don't know why it ever started. It just dropped out of the sky, which was, of course, patently false.
Yeah, yeah. And let me ask Carvin then. This is a very important part that the film makes you think about, even if the question isn't raised. I mean, essentially, the film makes the point that this was building, and that if this event on July 24th, 1964 hadn't happened, it feels like it would have happened a week later or a month later or a year later. Would you agree with that?
I agree 100%. It is likely that it would have happened because the circumstances that created it were real and present in people's lives almost on an ongoing daily basis. So what happened was, and we tried to find this in the film, and there's still a lot of discussion about the actual moment that this takes place, whether the police slapped the pregnant woman or a child was bitten by a dog.
Right.
This is lost in history. And in fact, people say it didn't happen. Captain Price, who came to visit, goes to talk to the school, World of Inquiry School, and does interviews, said that he checked and there were no police dog units out and available during the night, the evening of July 24th, 1964. But in people's minds, a police dog bit a child or a pregnant woman was slapped, because in people's minds it had happened so many times for real in
yeah.
the past that in a kind of temporal reality it did happen. And so that the perception of that, the myth of that, sets this whole thing into motion.
Yeah, the whatever the singular event that night, almost immaterial. But you talk about history sort of being told by those in the power to shape it. I mean, look at the issue of police brutality to begin with that the film raises. The police said over and over, and again, this is before those 3 days of confrontation. The police had said over and over, there is no brutality, that we are wrongly portrayed as brutal, that they were offended, that they were hurt by that. And Mayor Lamb largely backed them. But within the black community, there was a gentleman in the film, and his name is escaping, the former athlete.
Trent Jackson.
Trent Jackson. was saying you did not want to get arrested because if you got arrested, you were going to get beaten. And I don't know. Again, Carvin, it's almost like it's hard to know exactly where the line of truth was there. But boy, those stories were so different from what the police and the mayor were saying and what the black community was experiencing.
Well, there are so many moments in the film that bear this out. And I think when I look back at this film and I saw it the other day for the first time in maybe a year or so, I'm so proud of the work that we did and especially the work that Chris did in the interviews, because you have Mayor Lamb, who is credible, who is the mayor, the chief executive of the city, who sets policy and sets the tone for what happens. He is saying one thing. And then you have David Gantt, Representative Gantt, saying the exact opposite. Who's telling the truth? It's certainly a difference in perception. Mayor Lamb talks about, well, they were using police dogs because it was safer to use police dogs. It was safer. But people like Trent Jackson and Daryl Porter and David Gantt saw it from a different perspective. They saw the reality of it. So possibly both are true. Right? For people. That's what makes a great documentary, I think, is not you don't take a side as a filmmaker. I don't want to take a side. I want to give people information and let them make a choice. And I think most people think that Mayor Lamb was maybe the one who comes up short on the truth end of the stick.
It's hard to look at this film and feel that. I don't think Mayor Lamb is being dishonest. I think he was wrong in a lot of ways. That's what the film makes you. It doesn't make you look at him and feel like he's a villain or evil or anything like that. More just maybe out of touch with what an entire community was feeling, a community that was not getting jobs, a community that felt like there was not justice and opportunity. And so these things are starting to kind of boil over. And you mentioned the dogs. David Gantt and others in the film say that they felt like they were being treated like animals and sort of policed and attacked by
animals. Well, you know, this is important, and we sort of lose this in history now because we're just in a different time, and we're not confronted with this every day. But the people that were leaving their homes from communities like Sanford, Florida, and various places across the South to come north, they were coming north for a reason. They were coming to places like Rochester and Buffalo and Syracuse and Gary, Indiana and Chicago. They were coming for a reason. They were trying to escape a certain quality of life, a very heavily policed, heavily regulated, almost exclusively along racial lines, where they couldn't find the things that they needed. They couldn't find opportunity. So people were moving north in an odd way. Historic migration patterns are almost impossible to stop. We see this today with children coming from Guatemala and Nicaragua and El Salvador coming to the United States seeking the same thing. So these people were coming here looking for something, and imagine what happens when you leave the security of what you knew, even if you don't like it, and you come to a new place and you're treated worse than you were where you originally came from.
Especially when there are jobs. There are jobs to be had. There is success to be spread around. And so, again, that backstory in July 64 is almost as important, if not more so, than the telling of those events when they started unfolding. And again, I hope our listeners will take the time to watch this documentary as WXXI gets ready to show it again this coming Monday and then the following Sunday on WXXI-TV, and then two different times, 7 and 10 p.m. a week from today on City 12 if you happen to be in Rochester. Chris Christopher, the producer and writer of July 64, is in studio. Carvin Eisen, the director, is here. And this is one of those rare days on Connections where we're going to be a little freewheeling here. I've got some clips of sound that we're going to listen to, and Carvin has brought guests. In fact, the whole studio is filled. Our listeners can't see it, but you brought a packed house here, Carvin. Do you want to make some introductions here as well?
We made this film, and it's important, and I think we often joke we would have made a better film if we knew that there was going to be so much interest in this film.
I don't know if you could have. I mean, I really mean that.
You can always make a better film. Anybody that tells you you can't make a better film, they're not seeking to make a better film.
All right, fair enough.
But what we have today, we're making a new film, and we're tentatively calling the film July 14. And as part of the film, we are working with two groups of students, and we happen to have two representatives from those groups today. We have Victoria Tusk and Nakaya Nunley. Victoria is from the World of Inquiries, or Victoria is from the Harley School, and Nakaya is from World of Inquiry. And they represent, those two schools represent polar opposites in terms of one being an urban school district, from an urban school district, and the other one being a suburban private school. So what's incredibly interesting that we want to get to in this new film, we'd have to go back a little bit to set this up. One of the things that makes us make July 64 is the idea of public policy and its influence on how things are set up, mm-hmm. how healthcare takes place, how governance takes place, school systems, et cetera, policing, housing, et cetera. So one of the things that I am extremely interested in now is we have a long track record after this film now. We're looking at Rochester, Monroe County for 50 years since the event of July 64 took place. So what have the public policy decisions been that help us to arrive at where we are now? Right. So what's the experience that these young ladies are having in their respective school systems? Under normal circumstances, it is not likely that these two young ladies would meet each other. It's just not likely. Their paths would probably not cross. But we're hoping that their paths not only cross, but within the making of this film, July 14, they're an integral part, and we would like them, if you will, to tell each other's story. So if this film is successful, it would be like this. I would learn, Nakaya would learn so much about Victoria that she would be able to tell Victoria's story with accuracy and compassion, right, and understanding, and vice versa. Vicky would have to tell Nakaya's story with some understanding of who Nakaya is, what her life is about, what her circumstances are. This is my goal. This is my long-term goal. All right. So we made this film. We're making this film now. In 10 years, I would like those guys to make another film about Rochester.
No pressure on you guys.
We could see what has their life trajectory been.
Yeah.
What have they learned as they inherit the responsibility for governing and for managing our community? What will they do? What will their lives become?
Well, before we ask them about this project, Carvin, I'm concerned that in 50 years, and we talked a little bit about this yesterday on the program, I'm concerned that things have changed, but not enough has changed in Rochester. And I don't know if that's going to be part of what we find in the film, or maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I think this country in many ways has gotten over the easy stuff. The easy stuff was segregated bathrooms and restaurants, and, you know, blacks go this way, whites go this way. That is so ridiculous and wrong, and it's easy to see it. The subtle stuff is sort of the it can be the bigotry of low expectations. It can be the way a job interview goes for a person of color versus a white person. It can be all kinds of things, and I'm worried that things have changed, but in 50 years, not enough has changed.
Well, one of the incredible things about July 64, I think, and of course I'm biased, but Minister Florence says this better than anyone has ever said this, and I'll paraphrase. In the 60s, the problems were health, education, and jobs. And when we interviewed him in 64, in 04, he said, in the infancy of the 21st century, the problems are health, education, and jobs. So in a sense, you're right. There's an overlay of the same set of problems.
Yeah.
And the differences now are more stark because of the concentration of poverty within the city of Rochester. That is probably the most important and most significant factor that sort of sets everything into motion. And this is something that we need to discuss and we need to look at. Why is it that there is such a concentration of poverty within the city of Rochester that children living in Rochester, many children going to the school district of Rochester City School District, are confronting this issue? And we know that if you're concerned about what you're going to eat, if you're concerned about where you're going to stay, if you're concerned about, you know, the gunfire that you heard the morning before, if you're concerned about those kind of things, they obviously have to have an effect on your life. But this brings us to a really interesting point in history, because 10 years ago, we were barbarians at the gate knocking on the door, requesting information and trying to make a film. Now, Chris is actually on the other side of the equation. Chris is representing the city of Rochester, and I think that these are some good questions to pose to Chris about what the city and the county's plan is, right, for addressing some of these issues. I think that these are, and we have to call it what it is, it's the concentration of poverty. ACT Rochester, incredibly important organization. If you haven't had them on, you should have them on. Talk about a lot of the pathologies and a lot of the challenges that people face within the city of Rochester. But they don't talk about why there is no public housing, for example, why there's little public housing in suburban areas. And so I think that concentration where you have all of the unfortunate things coming together, crime-infested neighborhoods, failing school systems, poor nutrition, and food deserts. You have people contained. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's a containment. It's not a way. There's little chance of success. So those are some of the things that, you know, that drive my thinking about this film, but the new film. But I'm not content to just say, what are the problems?
Yeah.
I think the issue now is how can we solve them? So what I see as potential solutions is these two young ladies learning each other.
Well, and let me ask them, and I'll start with you, Nakia. You grow up, you've grown up where? Where's home for you?
Rochester, New York.
Rochester, New York. And as Carvin said, you may not otherwise cross paths too much with suburban students, and what have you already started to learn through this process?
I kind of learned that, I don't know, we have different lives, but certain points of our lives is the same, you know?
Have you gone through your childhood not interacting with suburban students much? Does it feel like a separation between city and suburb when you grow up?
I believe it's a big separation.
Big separation? And I think that's an issue across the country, not just Rochester. But what's the value, do you think, Nakia, in starting to break that down and trying to gain more of a relationship and an understanding with students across our area? I just froze you.
Yeah, I don't.
What do you think, Victoria? What do you think you gain by trying to develop relationships like this?
You gain an understanding and a certain insight to not only understanding your own story, but other people's. And I think that's really important, because when you learn and when you understand about, if I learn about kids in the urban area, I start to care. And then they start to care. And I think that ties a community together, because there isn't such a big difference between suburban and urban, or there shouldn't be.
Yeah. And if you don't have those real relationships, is it easy to let stereotypes rule your thinking?
Definitely. Definitely, because that's what you're told. If you don't learn it for yourself, you're going to be told the stereotypes.
Nakia, you are nodding immediately with that. I mean, isn't it easy just to have a stereotype of, well, kids from Pittsford this, kids from Brighton this, kids from Rochester this?
Yeah, it's a big stereotype between suburban and urban, I believe.
Well, I think that, I hope, Carvin, that this is just the seed for more understanding with that. And Victoria, you seem to indicate you already feel like it is, that this kind of interaction is going to change you. And maybe not just change you, but change the way you interact with people and what you do on a day-to-day basis, what you do in the future.
Definitely. When I, it was my first year at Harley this year. So when I joined Harley, they have so many opportunities to volunteer and to work and to have an interaction with Rochester. And I learned so many things that I never knew before. And I started caring about so many different things. My values changed, you know. And so I do think that this will change for a lot of people, even if you're not strictly involved in it. People who will hear about it will hopefully take interest in
it. And
care.
Evan, I just want to say in support of both of their schools, this is really important to me because we searched long and hard to find schools that will participate. And it is challenging. It may seem that that's something easy, but honestly speaking, it is difficult when you start talking about the school system and what children are going to learn and who they're going to be exposed to and what they're going to do. This is a true support and positive reflection on both of their schools to allow their students to be involved in this project. And this actually goes back to the original film because they both study, if I'm not mistaken, both schools on their own time have looked at July 64 and traveled to the neighborhoods, Joseph Avenue, for example, where events took place. And so they're seriously, both of these schools, Harley and World of Inquiry, the teachers in those schools are interested in providing an educational experience for these young people that is valuable. And we can't speak too much about that. We can't say enough about the importance of that.
All right, I'm not going to over-grill them, but I'll finish with this, Nikaya. When you grow up in the city of Rochester, is there a feeling that people in the suburbs care or don't care? Tell me what the mindset is like.
Well, I'm told, well, not told, but I think students in the city of Rochester, we think that they don't care. Well, we're told, like, we have the stereotype as they think they're better than us. You know, that's what we're told, and that's how we feel. So we think they don't care. So
Are you starting to feel differently in developing this relationship?
After we talk with the group of students from Harley, I believe they do care now, that they know what's going on in the city of Rochester.
And Victoria, what's it like for you to hear a student in the city say that they grew up thinking that you don't care?
It's not surprising. I mean, if you're growing up in the city and you hear about all these rich kids in the suburbs that are obviously, you know, it seems like they're not doing anything, it's not surprising to me that it seems that way.
But maybe there's an opportunity to do more, right?
Definitely. And I think that that stereotype needs to change and people need to be exposed to see that it's not true.
And it works both ways. I have to share this story. Nikaya will be able to co-sign on this. On the first day that we had them meet, it's about maybe just about a month ago, you brought a poster. Was it your poster that you brought?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she had an experience that was difficult to relate to Harley students and their families, right? You want to tell us why you made that poster?
The poster said Long Live Boo Boo, which was a student at Franklin who was killed maybe a month ago. And yeah, I made the poster. Basically in school we had like a remembrance type thing of him, and we just all sat and made posters and gave some posters to his mom. But it was just tragic. He was a student doing good and he was killed.
He became another homicide in the city of Rochester. And for suburban students to be exposed to that is just like urban students think suburban students don't care. I would imagine that school officials and parents might be cautious about their children coming into contact with such issues on a fairly dramatic way. So I applaud again both schools and sets of teachers and parents for even embarking on this because this is challenging. We went to many schools before we came up with these two schools that were willing to do this.
All right,
everybody said no.
I'm way late for a break and I think the students are on their own time schedules and they got to get out of here in just a second. So as we go to break, July 14, do you have a timetable for getting it out?
As soon come. in the true Jamaican way. As soon as it's made, you're going to see it. But we're projecting maybe next summer.
Thanks to the two students for taking the time to come in and tell us about your participation. And really appreciate your perspective. Thanks for being here. We're going to get to the phones next. If you're on the phone waiting to talk about July 64, we're going to hear some clips from that documentary and much more with the director, Carvin Eisen, the producer, Chris Christopher, and you on member-supported public radio. Stay with us. Coming up in our second hour, from July 64 to July 14, we continue the discussion about race, Rochester, and our community's future. Then we'll explore a film about the impact of your morning coffee. The film takes us to the small growing communities around the world. And we'll get some big news breaking about the Finger Lakes wine industry. It's all coming up next hour on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Villa of Hope, working with youth and their families to develop skills for lasting success. Specializing in trauma-informed care to support youth faced with chemical dependency, mental illness, poverty, and neglect. Learn more at villaofhope.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and I missed one of the screenings, in fact, coming up for July 64, the documentary about those 3 days in 1964 in Rochester. The Little Theater, as we understand it, the Little Theater is going to have a free screening. Chris, you're saying free, right? Free
screen. Yes, free.
On
Sunday.
Yeah, I only work with them. I should know this. Sunday.
Sunday at 6:30.
Sunday, 6:30.
And Carvin and I will be leading a discussion at the conclusion of the film.
All right, Sunday, 6:30, Little Theater. The film's only about an hour, and then a discussion to follow, 6:30 free at the Little Theater. And again, if you haven't seen it, that's a great opportunity to not only see it, but have a discussion with the filmmakers. You can see it on WXXI-TV this coming Monday, 9 p.m., the following Sunday, the 27th, at 11 p.m., and then two separate airings on the anniversary of that day that those events started. So that would be a week from today, the 24th, 7 and 10 p.m. on City 12. So
and
there you
also,
go.
Also, Evan, yep. At the end of each screening on WXXI and at the Little, they're going to show the trailer for the film I'm working on now. It's a little 4-minute glimpse.
So you may not be done, but you now. At least you got a you got a trailer. So.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Very good. Let's get to the phones, and we have Carlene. Carlene, thanks for waiting. Thanks for calling Connections.
I was actually present here in Rochester during this time. I'm looking forward to your film. I want to digress a little bit. I want to compliment the program you've established, because it was easier to get the colleges involved because it was a question of credit rather than these Harley and the other school that you have in the program. A little bit more difficult when it's just a free time activity. Here's my thoughts. One of the things I saw back then, although we have some of the same issues today, is we have an awful lot of transplants to Rochester now that we didn't have back then. I saw a migration of people coming from other areas where unemployment was even more severe than what we have here. For instance, people were coming from Puerto Rico, well-educated adults, but no jobs, 24% unemployment. It was a shock to me to learn that some of these children had been shifted between our system back and forth 2-3 times, as told by the students. And I think that the more that we can do to expose the multiculturalism and the fact that the children don't have a home in many cases, a home city, so to speak, we need to look at the issue here. While we think things are tough here, we're not realizing that many of the students have migrated from areas of even more of greater economic depression. Have you found that to be so?
Well, I think that that certainly is so. I think that you've characterized that directly. But it really raises an issue today that brings us back to the film. And Carvin touched on this, so let's just expand on this a little bit. And it's the concept of expectation. People came here at the early 60s. They are still coming here now because they're looking for something better. They're looking to improve their not only their own lot in life, but their family's future. And when those expectations go unmet, it's almost for many worse than the situation that they left. Wouldn't you agree, Carvin?
Absolutely. I can't say it better. The only thing I will say is that this is a problem. This is a national problem. I had an opportunity the other night to see the frontline program called Haves and Have-Nots, or Urban Suburban. You can almost substitute those terms. But in the city of Baton Rouge, the city of Baton Rouge is in the process of a community of people. About 70% of the wealthiest people in Baton Rouge are in the process of seceding from the city of Baton Rouge to create a new city called New St. George or St. George. And what it is, the reason that they're doing that is they don't want their kids going to school with children of color. It's as simple as that. They just don't want their kids. They wouldn't say it. They wouldn't come to terms with it. But you can see from the construction, and Frontline is very good in terms of presenting material. That's really what the issue was. So, you know, expectations. I hope in my life I'm able to figure out, why is it? Is it property values? Is that what drives everything? What is it that there are some people that just simply don't want to be associated with other people that they perceive to be different from them?
Well, I don't think that's a question of property values. I think that's actually a question for humankind, and not just an issue that we face in this country. You know, we've seen throughout human history one group pitted against another group for many different reasons. It's part of our human history, and something that I think that we have to acknowledge, examine, and decide that we are going to make a decision to work against that. We have to make an affirmative decision that we are not going to take up the same patterns that maybe our families did or others in our town did, and that takes a big leap, I think.
Let's get Eric in Brighton. Eric, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead.
Yes, this may be fitting as sort of a question for the end of the show, but I was wondering if you could address, what's the legacy of the 64 riots? Is it tragedy in the sense that we haven't learned the appropriate lesson and we're making the same mistakes, or is it opportunity in that we really are trying to sort of do things differently as a result? So what do you think the legacy has been?
I think it's a real mixed bag. I think certainly when it comes to housing, I was having a conversation with somebody today. The housing conditions that existed in the city of Rochester in the early 60s were absolutely deplorable. But we now have, as a matter of public policy, as Carvin spoke about, we have evolved a system of zoning regulations, of code regulations, of ways that properties have to be kept for people. Still not perfect, but certainly an extreme evolution in housing conditions. Can we do better? Yes. Do we need more housing? Yes. But have we made great strides since that time? Absolutely yes. On another level, two important organizations that still live, still are working in Rochester today, came directly out of the rebellion. The first is Action for a Better Community, and the second is the Urban League of Rochester. Both of those organizations do very, very important work in this community. But then the flip side is, let's look at our schools. In the 1960s, we actually had better educational outcomes than we have now. Why is that? Complicated question. If it could be easily answered, we'd be solving it, right? So unemployment. As Evan pointed out, we had a very, very low unemployment rate in Rochester and Monroe County in the 60s. Right now, today, in the city of Rochester, there are census tracts that have unemployment rates that are higher than they were during the Great Depression. So, you know, you could say the more things change, the more they stay the same. But are they the same things? And what is changing and what isn't changing? I think those really become the big and difficult questions.
And I would add, one of the things that we learned from making this film was that in 64, the problems that happened in two neighborhoods were the problems of housing, the problems of violence, and the lack of education. the difficulty with the police were contained in two neighborhoods relative to the city of Rochester. So you had that ratio. Today what we have is those problems are now the city of Rochester in relationship to the county of Monroe. So the problem has, in fact, escalated. It's the same set of problems. They've just escalated and been largely contained within the city. And to go deeper, the Act Rochester, these are not my statistics. This is what Act Rochester says in their community report card, that 65% of the children in the city school district are African American. And what that is also synonymous with is that 65% of the children are poor in the city school district. 9% of Latino and Black boys graduate from high school, according to the SHOT report. 9%. That requires a Marshall Plan to deal with that. The infant mortality rates for Black women are 269% higher than they are for white women. That's just almost beyond comprehension. So those are very real legacy issues, if you will, with respect to the issues of 64. So we just have to make up in our minds as a community that we want to address that, that we have the number. Rochester City School District, you know, there's a lot of good going on, and I think Nakaya and the World of Inquiry and Patrick Roush and everybody over there is doing a very good job. But on whole, it's out of 429 school districts in terms of measuring success, it is number 429. Within a 10-minute drive, the same measures that determine success, we have the number one school district in the Pittsford School District. So how is it that we could have in such a close geographic proximity the worst performing school district and the highest performing school district? That is a public policy issue that needs to be discussed.
Yeah, I think that's well said. If you want to join the program, you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We are kind of breaking the code a little bit today, and we're going to continue this discussion into the second hour because I haven't even gotten into the clips that I've pulled. And I want to – frankly, we haven't even gotten to the discussion of the actual 3 days themselves. And I think – so I know Carvin can stay. Chris had no idea if I was even going to ask her to stay. I have no idea what you – Chris has nothing to do, right?
I can't stay.
Chris cannot stay. All right. So Carvin can.
Yes, I can stay.
Yeah. So, I have nothing. So, Chris, we've got a few minutes left. Let me at least, Carvin, you've taken up enough air. Let's get.
And rightfully so.
A few minutes with Chris, then as we get ready to go into our second hour here. Some of the things that happened over those 3 days are shocking to even look back on. You have a WHEC reporter who is sort of dramatic in his descriptions of that. But when you see a police chief's car sort of burned out and knocked over, when you see the looting and the reaction the next day, the reaction on Saturday when the light came out and you saw the glass on the street and the storefronts knocked down and people looking at their businesses saying, that may be it for me, that emotion that you were able to bring to that was unbelievably powerful to me. How did you even sort through all the material that was out there? That had to be a Herculean task.
Well, I'm not going to say that it was easy. But there are things that people are willing to talk about 40 years later that they are not willing to talk about 40 hours, 40 days, 40 weeks, 40
months. That's a
great
point.
So there was a lot of pent-up emotion. There was a lot of desire on the part of some people to finally get the truth out, to finally be able to talk about these things in a way that they weren't going to be judged or it wasn't going to be held against them. I think that just the time was right to actually get this, the actual story on the record. We found that it was interesting that there were three kinds of interviews, really. There were people who, frankly, were emotionally invested, but not necessarily, their memories were not necessarily historically accurate, and provably so. There were people who wanted to set the record straight. And there were other people who wanted to create a new record or perhaps revise their legacy. So we needed to be very clear that who we were looking for were the people who were the absolute truth tellers. So that meant that we collected the interviews and then we had to go around and do a lot of research around the edges. This film took us a very long time to make. And the reason was that we wanted to be absolutely sure that what we were going to put on the record was really something that was valuable and was deserving of that place in history.
About a minute left here. When people saw that film, like you and Carvin have said, it was, for many people, a first lesson in that. A lot of people have grown up and not known the story in full. What's some of the feedback you've gotten?
Some people were shocked. Other people said, I had no idea. But for other people, it was extremely cathartic. The first viewing of this film was at the Dryden Theater on the 40th anniversary of the riot. We were shocked. There was a line out the theater mm-hmm. to the street. We had no idea. And then we showed the film, and people didn't want to stop talking about it. They didn't want to leave. I often tell people that it was so overwhelming. I kind of feel like it was my wedding. I know I was there. I know there was cake. But other than that, it just was so emotionally overpowering. That's been the effect that this film has had and continues to have.
Sunday, 6:30, Little Theater, free showing, discussion afterwards with Chris and Carvin. Chris has to hit the road now because she does have other things to do, it turns out.
Just to fix some of those problems.
She does. Chris is now working with the city of Rochester and, in fact, really well positioned to help a lot of people in city government understand some of those problems and communicate them. This film is one of the more important films that will ever be made in this community. You've done a tremendous job. Thank you for taking the time, Chris.
Thank you, Evan.
Carvin, hang here, and we're going to talk more about those 3 days. If you want to join the conversation, callers, join the conversation. You're going to hear more from July 64 next. From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Lest anyone be confused, this program does not celebrate the events of July 64. I don't think anyone has. But we seek to understand and educate. And the film, July 64, which came out 10 years ago now, marked 40 years at the time from the 3 days of confrontation that marked a very dark period in Rochester's history and has left certainly a legacy in many ways. Now we are looking at 50 years. 1 week from today, we mark 50 years from that Friday night, 1964, July 24th, in which I think you could call that Friday night a riot, and I think the rest of the 3 days would probably be called a rebellion. And there's a reason that those terms are used. We're going to be getting into that. The director of the film, Carvin Eisen, is still with us in studio here. Chris Christopher's had to leave us, but it's only fair if I tell you a little bit about their background, by the way. Chris Christopher, a 2-time Emmy Award-winning writer and producer and an alumnus of the Sundance Documentary Film Program. Her work has been recognized with many national awards, the Organization of American Historians Award, an Award of Excellence from the Broadcast Education Association. Of course, PBS WXXI has shown her work many, many times. And director Carvin Eisen has nearly 40 years of experience as a filmmaker working across the country and really around the world. He has received national recognition for his work through many organizations, 2 New York State Emmy nominations, a 25th anniversary Classic Gold Telly, 4 Bronze Tellys, the Award of Excellence from the Broadcast Education Association. I could go on, but Carvin, is that enough?
That's more than enough.
That's enough to start?
It's enough.
So the director is with us of July 64, and we're going to be showing that film once again on WXXI television this coming Sunday, the 21st at 9 p.m., then again, I should say this coming Monday, the 21st, 9 p.m., then the following Sunday, the 27th at 11 p.m. A week from today, City 12 will be showing the film at 7 and 10 p.m., and then you can also see the film for free at the Little Theater at 6:30 this coming Sunday with a discussion with Carvin and Chris to follow. Carvin, there's a lot of things we want to cover here. I want to open it up for phone calls again if you want to join the conversation. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Peter on Twitter is telling us that he's just learning about these events from this show today, even though he grew up here, have not seen the film yet. You haven't said yet if anyone died over those 3 days, and we're getting there, but Carvin, why don't we start there and answer Peter's question?
Well, there were 4 deaths, although 3 of them were tangentially related. There was, on the third day, a Sunday, there was a helicopter crash. A helicopter was trying to land between a rooming house and another building in a vacant lot on Clarissa Street, and he lost control of the helicopter, and the rooming house caught ablaze, and three people were killed in there. So that was a terrible, tragic kind of loss of life, or dramatic loss of life, and a tragically fantastic event. I mean, in the most horrible sense. So that was sort of the culmination of the whole thing. But the biggest issue was the property damage, the loss of face that people felt. And also, this is important because this was the first time that the National Guard was called out to stop a violence in a northern city in America. This is Rochester holds that distinction. So that's pretty significant. And it's also significant because lots of films have been made about the civil rights era, and a lot of really good films. But very few films were made about how riots and disturbances, rebellions, whatever you want to call them, affected small, mid-sized northern cities. And Rochester is a case study for that.
So 3 days, four people died, roughly 350 were injured, 1,000 people were arrested, 200 businesses were damaged or looted. So you can see, obviously, a very serious event. We're going to get back to the phones in a minute, but when the term race riots come up, people are sensitive to that, Carbon. Is that the wrong term for those 3 days?
Well, when we started on this project, I had also heard the term race riot. And I started looking into, Chris and I both, what is a race riot? And a race riot in the classic sense is a fight, if you will, on a large scale between two different racial groups. I mean, it's classically what it is. You know, that would be, you know, the Bosnians and the Serbs, the Hutu and the Tutsi, you know, the Arabs and Jews, you know, that could be, those could,
Sunni and Shia.
Sunni and Shia could be considered, right, on those terms. But in Rochester, that's not what happened. It was not a race riot. And it's difficult to hear those terms. There weren't mass groups of white Rochesterians in battle with mass groups of black Rochesterians. Thank God that never happened. That did not happen. What you had is a classic riot, especially on the first night, a response to oppression, a response to lack of opportunity, a response to aggressive police behavior. And I mean aggressive police behavior. And a trigger mechanism set it off, and this is classic. Anywhere events like this happen around the world, there's a trigger mechanism that jumps this off. And so that's what happened. That's really what it was. It was a riot in that regard. But then, and I think Dr. Turner says this so brilliantly in the film, when it goes on for days, right, then we're dealing with something else. We're dealing with something altogether different.
And we're going to get to a clip of that in just a second, but I do want to grab a phone call. This is Lucia in the city of Rochester. Go ahead, Lucia.
Yeah, hi, thanks. Great program. I'm a teacher for the city school district, and I'd like to say that, you know, a big difference between now and 1964 is the presence of many more immigrants from Asia, say Nepal, Yemen and Middle East, Southeast Asia. We have kids from all over the world, basically, all the other continents, including Central America, Latin America, Puerto Rico, et cetera. And what I and many other teachers in the city school district strive for, especially the ESSO teachers, is to have opportunities for the kids to be with each other and educate each other. You know, you mentioned that you've got kids from the city school district working with that girl from Harley, you know, black, white, suburban, urban connections. Well, we need to really focus, too, on the kids that are in the city school district who come from these huge, various ethnic backgrounds to and racial backgrounds to come together and learn from each other. And one of the things that distresses me as a city school district teacher is that we, after putting in many years to get their language skills up, many families leave the city school district and they go to Iran, to Kuwait, or Greece, and they get to graduate the kids that we would have graduated. And what comes up in the conversations, and I talk to the kids, why are you leaving? And they will say it's the distressful, the disruptive behavior that they see, because they're coming from cultures where education is prized. And so they leave, and they don't want to leave, but they do. And so it's a much more nuanced conversation, I feel, that needs to be had. Furthermore, it seems to me that children, regardless of whether African American or Latin or Asian, their parents will leave the city, and mainly for they think that they're going to get better services in the suburbs or whatever the reasons are. But as I say, a distressful reason for me to hear is that they don't want to be in situations where there is physical fighting and disrespect to teachers and to the learning process. It's a very complicated, nuanced conversation. Any comments you could make,
I
off the air.
I appreciate that, Lucia. Thanks for the phone call. What do you think, Carmen?
I think that she's absolutely correct. Everything is always more complicated than it's presented on the surface and in the media. And there is no question that it's more nuanced than, you know, black and white, you know, no pun intended. But there are realities that we have to deal with. And I think the basic issue for the city is what has already been said and needs to be said until something is done about it. It is the concentration of poverty. It is the fact that 65% and more than 65% of the schools in Rochester have to deal with poverty as a determining factor, as an influence on the lives and the behavior of kids. And when kids are coming to school, not knowing when they're going to eat, some kids don't have homes to live in, some kids are dealing with violence, as Lucia has said, right? That this is going to influence how they behave. I think we need a Marshall Plan, if you will, a whole overhaul of how we approach education. We're teaching analog concepts in a digital world. That's essentially what's happening. We're not taking advantage of technology. The whole concept of what is being taught, even in some cases, is irrelevant to the lives of people, to the lives of students. But yet they have to go through this. And this starts to get into some very interesting kinds of conversations when you understand it at that level.
We have a question from Jake on Twitter. After July 64, what direct changes occurred as a result? And I'm going to let Carvin jump on that in just a second. But that is a very good question that allows an important part of context here. And that is this. We're talking about roughly 200 businesses that were damaged or looted. That, for some of those business owners, that was the end of their downtown business. They either closed shop and they were done. Some moved out to the suburbs, etc. There's no question that those demonstrations terribly affected businesses. And certainly it's true that some of those were white-owned businesses and they were done in the city after that. The issue with these events, and this is why I think the film is so important, if you choose to look at the history, if your starting point for understanding what happened is Friday, July 24th, 1964, and you see the riot that night and the demonstrations the next 2 days, the National Guard comes in, businesses, a lot of them close and leave, some white people leave the city, certainly some Jewish people leave the city. If your starting point for understanding is that Friday night, of course, you're going to look at this situation and you're going to say, well, look at what the black people did to our city. We didn't have a lot of black people in Rochester before 1950. They move up here. Look what they did. They forced us out. If you fail to look back to 1950, you don't have that context to fully understand. And nobody is celebrating what happened. Nobody's saying those were good things or good actions. But part of the point of the film is to say, look at the context here. This was a city that was thriving. There were people who were leaving the Jim Crow South looking for opportunity. They saw this great city. There were 10,000 jobs open. There were factory jobs here. And a lot of black people got here, and they were refused those jobs. They felt the police were rough with them. They continually were denied opportunity, and then it exploded. And it was terrible that it exploded that way. But to me, that's the prism of understanding it. You got to start in 1950.
I think you're, Evan, you're on the mark there without question. And let's say, and this is often used as a reason why people were unable to get those jobs. The immigrants that were coming here were coming from an agricultural-based lifestyle, right? Farming, migrant farming, etc. And the jobs that they were coming to here, this was the Silicon Valley of its era. This was high tech. Cybron, Xerox, Kodak, these were tool and die makers and really fine sets of skills. But the problem was there was the lack of will to educate and bring these people into job programs, into teaching programs, into opportunities that would prepare them to take the job. They simply were not welcomed. And I think that's what a lot of people responded to. That's what ultimately made this happen. And I also think we have to go a little bit deeper into the loss of businesses. One of the things that we learned in making the film July 64 was that many of the businesses that some will fondly look at through the prism of history, right? Many of these businesses were double and triple charging black residents for goods and services, charging more for coal, charging more for heating oil, charging more for bologna, you know, just charging more, gouging people because they had no recourse. They had no place else to go. So and you can tell when you really look into this, the violence patterns on the street that night, stores that did not do that to people, such as the Mangione store, Chuck Mangione's father, Chuck and Gap's father and family, their store was untouched, and there were many other stores that were untouched. But the stores where shop owners were actively gouging and taking advantage of people who had already been taken advantage of, they met a different fate. So, you know, when we look at this, we have to look at the complete picture of this, and that those happen to be facts.
This was also during a time, roughly 1930 to 1960 in this country, you could look at Chicago. You could look at a lot of American cities in the North where, again, the black population came for opportunity escaping the South. And what they found in the mortgage industry was a lot of black people couldn't even get a real mortgage. They, instead of building equity, they were making payments essentially to a middleman. And if they missed one payment, they lost their property and they had no equity to fall back on. That after they were often paying 50 to 100% more. For a property. That's the way black people were treated for 30 years in this country.
Evan, I would invite your listeners to read the Atlantic Magazine article by Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yeah, we've talked about it in this program.
Yes, this is an important article. This is maybe one of the most important articles that's been written recently about American history that affects all Americans, not just black Americans. But in essence, what Mr. Coates says is that after 250 years of slavery, 90 years of separate but equal, the Supreme Court decision, 60 years of government policy, which alludes to what you're talking about, the policy was that there will be less opportunity and less resource for people who happen to be black. This has been the model. This has been the pattern in American history. And not recent, but since Africans came to the shores of America. And then at the same time, you tell people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and to take responsibility. And I think that is a very important message. Don't get me wrong. I am for that. This is what I preach to my students, black and white, and to my son exclusively. You have to take responsibility for yourself. But when you tell people to take responsibility for themselves, and then you remove every support mechanism that they would use to improve themselves, and then you castigate them for not doing well, we have a problem.
Yeah, and for anybody who has not seen July 64, you're not going to see a documentary that celebrates those events.
Absolutely.
You're going to see a documentary that tries to explain what led to them, what came out of them, what happened during those 72 hours. And that film does not say, hey, thumbs up to the people who did that. They were some sort of justice seekers. I understand a lot of people felt like that was their method for seeking justice. No one is saying good for you for picking up stones and throwing them. And again, you're going to hear a clip in a minute, but let me stay with the phones. This is Sue in Fairport. Go ahead, Sue. Not Sue. Ken, I've got it backwards. Ken, I'm backwards here. Ken, thanks for calling. My apologies, Ken. Go ahead.
Sure. Hi. When I was a teenager, about 17, I worked at my dad's store, which was at the corner of Joseph and Baden Streets. They were renting party supplies and medical equipment and also selling furniture. And I happened to be working on the day of the riot. And I was outside sweeping. And a man came up to me and he said, "Man, there's going to be a war. There is going to be a war." And frankly, I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I went in and mentioned this to my father. And we sort of thought it was very strange. So my question is, how much was this a spontaneous event, and what is the possibility that a lot of this was pent up demand for some sort of riotous action that was touched off by this one incident? I mean, did people know that something big was going to happen? I mean, here this man on the day of the riot told me there was going to be a war. So I also have one more comment. For Mr. Eisen, I saw your film, and I really think highly of it. What you just said, though, about the good white guys who took care of the neighborhood, they didn't get harmed, and other retailers who were gouging the neighborhood were rioted and looted. I would dispute that, and my family was in no way gouging the people. And in fact, my uncle became the head of the Joseph Avenue Businessmen's Association and worked with Saul Alinsky and others to solve the problems. But so that's my comment and my question.
Ken, thank you very much for the comment. Carvin, first of all, he's saying that there were definitely white people who were not hurting black people, and they had their businesses terribly impacted, looted, et cetera. Do you dispute that?
Well, I was a little boy in Buffalo, New York, so I was 11 years old. I wasn't even here. I will just say that I certainly appreciate what Ken has said and his sensibility, and he knows what he saw. I cannot dispute that and wouldn't even try to. I believe that what he is saying is truthful for him. But we spoke to so many other people who said the opposite, so many people who said that who have a direct memory, such as his memory, that they were gouged and they did feel that they were taken advantage of. And I think the record shows it may not be, let's say, in terms of his particular family and their particular business. But, for example, there were landlords who had houses that would have normally been for one family. They were divided up into 16 rooms to make 16 studio apartments with a refrigerator and a two-plate burner in each one. That is beyond dispute. So that mindset, whether it was him, and I will acknowledge that that was not his family and that is not what happened for him, but that certainly was present, and that is what people remembered. And I don't think people would have come, so many people would have come and told us that if they didn't believe that to be true.
All right, now how about his comment that he said his experience was someone said there's a war coming and that the notion of what happened on that Friday night was even more premeditated.
Well, If you watch the film carefully and you listen to Constance Mitchell, she talks about this in the film. She said, we had our ear to the ground and we knew something was going on. Right. This is before July 24th. We knew because we worked with young people and we were on the streets. We knew something that was in the air. They could feel it. So in that sense, that's not inconsistent with what this guy is saying, with what Ken is saying. That was probably the feeling at the time. And also, Evan, I think it's important to understand this era of American history. These were volatile times. This was the beginning of the 60s. Kennedy had just been killed less than a year before. The voters' rights activity, voter rights registration issues, all sorts of civil rights ideas were percolating under the surface. And this was about to explode across the country. So, yes, it may be true that, and I'm going to say that it was true for this, for Ken who called, but we also cannot get away from what our history was in America at that time. There was serious oppression, and people had taken about as much of it as they could through what they considered the legal redress.
Yeah, and that's why in the first hour of our conversation, I asked if that event had not happened on July 24th, would it have happened a week later, a month later, a year later? And the answer is almost certainly yes. So to answer Ken's question, that first night was much more like a riot than a planned event, but everyone knew at some point something was going to happen if things didn't change. That doesn't make it right, but that's probably the condition. Now, having said all that, you wake up on that Saturday, and it is shocking to walk down Joseph and to see the glass on the street and the businesses impacted and the arrests and the injuries and the people who were hurt. And it was a shocking morning, but you had hoped that at that point maybe things can sort of calm down. Well, that's why Chris Christopher says then it becomes a rebellion. It's not a riot after that. It's not 3 days of race riots. It's sort of a planned rebellion. Do you agree with that characterization?
I'm going to say that I agree with that. I do really think, and I think that rebellion is a perfect word to use. And a rebellion is a response, a resistance to authority, resistance to circumstances and to a situation that is not meeting your needs and not hearing you, not listening to you. You go to the police and you are beaten by the police. You go to the court system, you have no redress, you have no opportunity to be heard. You go to get an employment, for employment, and your application is thrown in the circular file. So there's a lot of hostility, there's a lot of anxiety because people can't provide the basic needs for their family. This creates a rough circumstance. If this were to happen today, right, the response would be similar in any place in the world. It would be similar, and it does happen. So I agree. I really do think it was a rebellion, and I don't think that's revisionist history. I think that is the more proper characterization, because a riot is what happens when Brazil got beat by Germany so badly. That's a riot. You know, people are upset momentarily.
And they burn a few cars.
Right, exactly. That's a riot after. And even sometimes it's a riot even when your team wins. Right. There have been like in Kentucky, when Kentucky wins, you know, there's in Louisville, there's all sorts of activity that also becomes a riot. But in this particular case, this was, in fact, a rebellion. And I stand by that.
Yeah. And again, he's not saying it was noble and right. I mean, I don't know what Martin Luther King would have said about that. Martin Luther King wouldn't have been throwing a brick through a window on Saturday night, especially when 24 hours earlier there were people clashing with police and businesses destroyed. He would have said, we got to get this under control. But that's what happened. So let's get back to the phones. This is Mary Jane in Webster. Mary Jane, thanks for calling. You're on with Director Carvin Eisen.
Well, this topic just goes to my heart. And I think, how long is it going to take us to recognize each other as human beings and treat each other? When my mother was a young girl and worked in the button factory on State Street, she told us of that story when she would go to work, walking from the northern end of the city up to State Street, there was a black woman there who was so gracious to her that she would share her lunch with my mother. And my mother would tell this story over and over again. When I was a teenager, we moved to a street in Rochester where I really met my first family of black people. And my mother would solicit the neighborhood at a time when someone died to get donations for a gift to the family who had lost a loved one. And she would come back and she would say, I was in that black family's home. Oh, I can tell you, you could eat off their floor. These were the blacks that I grew up with. So when it came time to go to a migrant camp, I was very willing. People from Sanford, Florida, which was mentioned on your program, they were there doing a beautiful job of picking our fruits and vegetables. I took my children with us. We took our children with us, and it was just a wonderful time for them. So when they went to Franklin High School, they had lots of black friends. They were told at one time by a teacher to my daughter, why don't you stay with your own kind? Mm. And she came back and she was just, terribly upset about that.
But Mary Jane, before because we're going to have to move along here in just a second, mm-hmm. do you get the sense that things have changed from that?
Not as much as I would like to see.
Yeah.
Our church was bought over by a black congregation, and they had people coming to their convention and needed housing for them. We had housing in our home for them. What an interesting event that was, you know, to have people coming from St. Thomas, all over. And I just think of Martin Luther King saying people fail to get along because they fear each other.
I've got to run here, Mary Jane. I think that's a great line to end that coming on, Carvin. Don't you think?
Oh, lovely. And, you know, she has a wonderful point, and I feel it in her heart as she speaks, her capacity to love and her capacity for compassion and empathy and understanding. And we certainly need more of that.
I'm way late for a break, and the phones are blowing up here. So let's take the shortest break in radio. I've dragged poor Carvin through a second hour, but there's so many phone calls. Can you stay for the rest of the hour? I don't want to deny the conversation that's coming out of this. Carvin Eisen, the director of July 64, in studio with us. Short break and right back with him. I'm Evan Dawson on the next Connections. It's Healthy Friday. My colleague Elisa Orlando puts you in touch with the medical community. And the second hour is a new edition of Second Opinion Live. You can interact by phone or by joining the discussion on social media outlets. Healthy Friday. Your questions answered. Coming up on the next Connections. See you Friday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. July 64 is a documentary about the 3 days of conflict in the city of Rochester that some refer to as the race riots. But as you're hearing this hour, there's a lot of different ways to characterize what happened without sort of either using the wrong term or even celebrating what happened. We're trying to understand what happened with the director of the film, Carvin Eisen. And I want to get back to the phones because they're jammed up here, and Carvin is nice enough to stay and join this conversation through the rest of the hour. So this is Paul in Irondequoit. Paul, I know you saw the film. What do you think?
Very good, very good. You got to take what the film's giving you with they're trying to present something to you rather quickly as compared to what the world really was, a broad brush, if you will. And so some of their words or descriptions are not going to be quite right. I was actually there. I was on the corner of Clifford and Clinton picking up my papers in the morning. And for me, this was my neighborhood. You've mentioned names, and I grew up with them guys. And it wasn't like a racism like they're trying to explain to you, where I hated my next-door neighbor or something like that. It was an overall change of the environment, and it was a time of change across the country and change that was to come. And this was the start of it. So, you know, if you know, like he's trying to tell you, it's rebellion. It's really not racism among individual people. The other thing that I kind of disagree with was the employment picture. I can name dozens of people that I went to Franklin High School with that worked at all the factories in Rochester. They came to the schools and they gave you applications. We had 2 or 3% unemployment at the time, as he said. Well, you know, you kind of can't have it both ways. There's a lot of people of all races that just aren't going to participate. And, you know, I mean, that's all there is to it. I mean, they're just here for what they can get, and then they move on.
So. Well, let me let Carvin respond. Paul, thanks for the call. He's saying that there are plenty of black people who just didn't work because they didn't either weren't participating, or that your film overblows the problem of black unemployment.
I am very sensitive to Paul's point of view and respect his opinion. However, he may be talking about the era of Saul Alinsky after the riot, when Minister Florence and a cohort, a collection of people, worked very, very hard to open up Kodak so that it would hire people of color. And that did not happen before July 64. It just simply did not happen. Now, were there places where people were employed? Of course there were. There were opportunities. But I'm talking about a policy, a general policy of exclusion. And this is what people forget. People sometimes will paint with a very broad brush this idea of inclusion and seeing things the way that they, in fact, would like to see them. I'm not saying this about this person, but this whole idea of race and racial difference and racial animus is a real thing in American culture. We have to deal with it. Certainly things are better. There is no question about it. Things are better than they were 50 years ago in many different ways. And I think you, when you, as you opened up the first hour, you talk about that eloquently. But we still have to come to terms with some very basic facts, that race is still pervasive and it is used. It is used and it is often disguised. It is disguised in terms of poverty. Poverty has become synonymous with the term race. It is used for executing certain policies that are no longer called racial policies, but they are policies of exclusion, policies that cause the majority of poor people to live contained, walled in communities that fail, high crime rated communities, food deserts, failing schools, high infant mortality, with little opportunity for success. That is a public policy decision, that when poverty is concentrated within one area, then that frees other areas to even have to deal with the problem. The surrounding communities, suburban communities, don't have to build affordable housing because they don't want affordable housing in their communities. They don't want their property values to be diminished by the fact that some person of color who may not be able to pay the kind of mortgage rates and purchase a home in some of these communities. But that is a very, very real problem that has real consequences.
Karen in the city of Rochester was there during the riots. Thanks for calling Connections, Karen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that I have to take issue with the comment about gouging the community. You know, I grew up on Joseph Avenue. My father had a business there. We never felt uncomfortable. We were definitely part of the community, as well as many of the other businesses in our area. We helped in many ways, and all of the other businesses that I knew of at that point were helping the community as far as, you know, credit without gouging, and helping with kids and seeing what they needed. And we really were a big part of that community, and the community was a big part of us. And I also have to say that we would have stayed there, and we would have continued on having businesses on Joseph Avenue, but we could not get insurance, number one. And when Urban Renewal came in and purchased our property, to this day, you know, 50 years later, it's still vacant. So I think that those kind of blanket statements are pretty dangerous. And I will also say, in regards to what everybody else is saying, we were warned. The community, the neighbors came to us and warned us that something was going to be happening. And that's why we were there so late that evening trying to protect some of the assets that we had in our business. And as we pulled, made a U-turn and pulled off Joseph Avenue, the first rock went right through our store. So I just have a bad feeling about blanket statements like that.
Karen, thanks for the call. I appreciate the call, Carmen.
Well, Karen, I again appreciate your point of view, and I'm going to certainly acknowledge and give credence to what you say happened for you and believe that it's absolutely true. However, we spoke to too many people who said the exact opposite. And I will only say this. If those things didn't happen, if people weren't being charged more for food and for heating oil and for goods and services, then why did they riot? Then why did they do it if they weren't? Did they just that? Then if the answer to that question is something different, then we have to go back and make another film, because those were the circumstances at this time. And I'm willing to believe, and I really do believe in my heart, that there are good people. And Karen is one of them. And Paul, the other person that called, is one of them. And their remembrances and what they did, what they may have done, is absolutely true. Right. But clearly, the historical record shows clearly that other forces were at work. There had to be. Otherwise, the city, the riot on July 24th would never have taken place.
Steve in Fairport. Steve, thanks for calling.
Oh, hey. I've been listening to the show, so my thing has changed a little bit. But I'm a retired teacher from the city school district where I worked for almost 30 years. And then before that, I worked as an administrator in CETA, the Comprehensive Employment Act. And listening to your people talking and to your conversation in general, I don't think most people understand or appreciate the structure of poverty and how difficult it is for some individual to get out of it. And then the other thing I want to say is that you're creating, you're discussing an issue that I think America needs to have about race, and it is a charged issue. And something I learned a long time ago was that when you confront people who have a firm belief in a faulted or a faulty system, their first response is to get very angry. And then follows with one of two avenues. They either come to enlightenment or they just look for a narrative that makes their faulty belief system work. And that's all I need to say.
Steve,
I want to thank you for starting the conversation.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Steve. What do you think, Carmen?
Well, I'm not sure on which side to interpret that. Is he saying that the people that spoke before are sticking to their narrative? Is he saying that I'm sticking to a narrative? All I can say about the film is that we made a film, and for 10 years going now, we're in our 11th year now, this film has been in high demand across the country. It is in hundreds of libraries across the country, including the Library of Congress. So something about the film struck a chord, and the film becomes a focal point to initiate discussion. And that is probably all we can ask for the film to do. And about that, I'm very happy. I do think that there needs to be more honest discussions about race. And there are very many organizations, very good organizations, Ann Johnson and the work they're doing with ACT Rochester and the Facing Race, Embracing Equity. I think those are very important. And I think those conversations need to extend and be included. I think the one thing we talk about housing, we talk about employment, we talk about criminal justice, health care, but rarely do we talk about the media and the media's role in the maintenance of what I call the status quo, and how race is depicted in the media and how it's not depicted. And I think that's one of the reasons that I'm so excited about working with these young people, because they're seeing it in ways that we haven't imagined it before.
Carvin Eisen is the director of July 64, and it looks at those 3 days in July 1964 in Rochester of demonstrations, what preceded them and then what came after them. Now, in that film, again, you had Mayor Lamb and other people denying that the police were rough with the black community and acted inappropriately. The first day of the rioting, Friday night, on Saturday, the question became, how are police handling it? How are they reacting? And word got out that police were giving orders on you might have to shoot to kill and things like that. And I want to listen to what Mayor Lamb said in response to that.
Police were, instructed that was the last resort. And it never got to that, thank God. And so I think that was a total fallacy.
Total fallacy, Carbon.
That is to me, that's one of the great moments in the film, because it obviously builds up to that. But, when he's saying that, and what your listeners can't see is his face, the kind of ambiguity in the statement. He leans forward. He licks his lips. He looks up. He's wondering. He's seriously considering what it is that he's saying. And this was one of the interviews that Chris talked about, where we strongly feel, at no disrespect to Frank Lamb, former Mayor Frank Lamb, and his estate, but this is one of the interviews that I felt that he came to set the record straight, the historical record straight. So what can we say about the police, right? Yes, fortunately, there was no shooting to kill. No one was shot by the police officers at that time during those 3 days. That's a good thing. But what we have to look at was, what was the relationship between the police and the black community? And there are many instances in that film, July 64, where people like Daryl Porter and Trent Jackson and David Gantt talk about their direct observation and their direct relationship with the police and police dogs. Cut to 2014. Benny Warr and the police, where Benny Warr is sitting in a wheelchair on a city street, and is knocked out of his wheelchair by two police officers. I'm not going to take one side or the other. That's a relationship with the police. Talk about Brenda Hardaway, a pregnant woman who is on video. I'm not going to talk about what happened before or after. I'm talking about a visual of a woman being punched in the back of the head by a police officer who is pregnant and wrestled to the ground. That's a relationship with the police. So there's a long history in Rochester with respect to the black community and the police department. We could go back to Denise Hawkins. We could go back to Michael Leach, who shoots Denise Hawkins in 1974, when I just came to Rochester. So there's a long, long, long history of that. And I believe that Frank Lamb is accurate in what he says, in what he wants to portray. I believe that, but I believe that it's way more complicated than that, especially when you're on the other end of it. I'll think of this one clip that you could have played, and hopefully people will see. Minister Florence says at a Sunday morning service, a police officer comes into a church, gun, cap, dog, Sunday morning service. So, there's a lot there. There's a lot in Rochester, New York, between the police maintenance, and black community, particularly young black males.
On the issue of whether it was a riot or a rebellion, again, on that Saturday, the question of what happens next, this is a clip from the film where that discussion comes up on when did it really become a rebellion, or how would you really characterize what's going on? Let's listen.
When you looked on the street, there was grandmothers, fathers, uncles, aunties, young people, because folk were actually, and they didn't look at this as a riot. They looked at it as a rebellion.
Whose voice are we hearing there?
That was Minister Franklin Florence, one of the sage, most important members of the community, who's been in the field for a very long time, is still working today, was arrested a couple of years ago dealing with the public defender issue, still working, still in the field. And those were his words as a young man. It was a rebellion. That's the way that he saw it. That's the way that they looked at it. And I'm inclined to go along with what he said. I wasn't there. I can only present information and let people make their own choice about what they hear. But I think it's probably very credible what he's saying.
Carvin Eisen has been my guest today, and want to tell you again when you can see July 64. You have a number of opportunities coming up, starting with Sunday at 6:30 at the Little Theater. It's a free showing of July 64. Carvin Eisen, the director, Chris Christopher, the writer and producer, will be there for discussion afterward. This coming Monday on WXXI-TV at 9 p.m. we'll be showing July 64. The following Sunday, this 27th, at 11 p.m. on WXXI-TV. 1 week from today is marking 50 years since July 24th, 1964, when those events happened. So 1 week from today on City 12, if you happen to be living in Rochester and have Time Warner Cable, it's 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. Carvin, only about a minute left here. You had no idea when you created this film. At least we don't have to agree on the rights, the wrongs, and certain interpretations. But the conversations need to be had, and you had no idea what you were creating, did you?
We didn't have any idea that the film would be used so much and be such a contribution to the city of Rochester and our area. And for that, we are very, very proud. And I can understand that people will differ in their opinion, and that's what's healthy, that's what's good. And if the film does nothing more than promote conversation and get people to discuss issues, right, what's better? We can talk about what's significantly better since 1964. But while talking about that, we have to also talk about what we need to continue to work on. And we need everyone in our community involved with this, everyone at all dimensions of our community. Everyone in this community should participate in this. So I thank you for that. I thank you for this opportunity. And I also just would say real quick, you are doing a great job taking over for the giant Bob, who is no longer here working at the station. You are doing a great job, and I really appreciate that.
Well, Carvin, that's very, very nice of you to say. I take the role very seriously, and Bob is certainly missed. Jake asked online if there's any place online to see the film. You cannot watch it online. A lot of libraries have it that you can get it out, as you mentioned.
You can go to californianewsreel.org and you can get your own copy.
You can get your own copy through them. So, Carvin, thanks for taking the time, and we'll see you Sunday at the Little Theater.
Thank you very much.
Carvin Eisen, director. And my thanks to John Andrus, who has been engineering today's show. I'm Evan Dawson. Thank you for taking the time to join us on member-supported public radio.